Morning, Your Honor. I represent the appellant, Billy Lynn Thompson, in her individual capacity as substitute trustee of the estate of William F. Derrickson. I'll start with my second argument because I don't intend to spend much time on that. Essentially, the master decided the division of the 193-acre farm located on Wharf Road and on Route 1 on the basis of who would annex. Unfortunately, the master did not have an evidentiary hearing. It seems to me that the master should have had an evidentiary hearing because there is a certain degree of credibility determination. And under the decision in the matter of real estate of Jamie's LLC, when there's a credibility determination, the chancellor should have had a limited hearing to determine that factual question. The more important issue which we've raised on the appeal is our first argument, and that's the jurisdictional argument. I start with the premise, and I think it's conceded by both, or understood by both the appellates and the appellees.
If I can interrupt you, Mr. Sirkovich.
Sure.
If I understand the jurisdiction argument, it's that you know, putting aside the fact that it was not disclosed to the court until the last minute or later, that the parties who were seeking partition did not own the, or co-own the property jointly or outright, but rather that the title was held in the name of the partnership, that destroyed the Court of Chancery jurisdiction to entertain a partition proceeding. Is that your argument?
That's our position, Your Honor.
Okay. My question is this. Is that really a jurisdictional? Does that create a jurisdictional defect? Let me preface the question this way. Jurisdiction means that the court lacks power over the subject matter of whatever the controversy is. Isn't it fair to say that even under these different facts that the court had power to dissolve the partnership that was the, if it is a fact, it was the title holder of this property for which partition was being sought? And if that's the case, then wasn't the proper procedure simply to proceed with some sort of dissolution of the partnership followed by a partition and allow the amendment of the complaint to conform to the evidence?
Your Honor, I understand that the petition asserted Chancery Court jurisdiction under the partition statute and that the
They invoked Chancery jurisdiction, and that was the cause of action, right?
That's correct.
All right. And your, you know, your point is that because it turned out, in fact, that the parties did not own or co-own the property outright, that that basically destroyed the cause of action. But does it destroy subject matter jurisdiction?
Yes, because subject matter jurisdiction was invoked pursuant to that statutory basis. And
let me go at it a slightly different way. Do you agree that, assuming this problem is insurmountable, which you contend it is because it's a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, assuming it's an insurmountable problem, what you would have happen is that we go back, or you go back, file appropriate proceedings to dissolve the partnership, upon dissolution of the partnership, the asset, the property, then gets distributed to the two 50% owners or their heirs, at which point they own the property as tenants in common, and there is then a partition. Is that what you would envision happening?
No, it is not,
okay.
Justice. What I envision happening is, if I understand the statute that was in effect when the partnership dissolved as a matter of law, the property vests in the surviving partner, then and then it vests in the heir of the last surviving partner. That's how title is held, I believe, under the statute. The surviving partner or the estate then has a duty to wind up. My understanding of the partnership statute, in effect, Ben, and I think as currently amended, is the statute contemplates the surviving partner or personal representative of the last surviving partner to liquidate the assets, discharge any debt, and then distribute cash to the economic interest holders who would have been the heirs of the deceased partners. That's the way I understand the procedure.
So the property has to be sold under the statute? It can't be liquidated in kind? Is that what you're saying?
There's nothing clear in the statute. The statutory references...
I mean, in partnerships, when partnerships are dissolved, it often happens that the assets of the partnership are distributed in kind.
The way I read the... And again, the problem is we don't have a record to contemplate exactly what would happen in a partnership winding up after dissolution. We simply don't have a record.
Yeah, but your argument is not one that requires a record. It presupposes that the statute commands that the property that's the subject of the winding up, which should have been done by your client decades ago or years ago but wasn't, must be sold for cash and can't be subdivided.
Well,
there's no authority for that in your brief.
Well, again, there's no authority for that in my brief because the how the property would be disposed of under the partnership statutes, there's simply no record before this court to determine what would occur. There are permutations and combinations. One of the statutory provisions, and again, we didn't, because there's no record, one of the statutory provisions under the amended act is the parties can waive winding up after dissolution, and that could have occurred in this case because we do have income tax returns being filed between the current persons who have an interest in the race.
So okay, let me try it a different way still. Would you agree that one possible way, if all the parties wanted to, one possible way of winding up the partnership could be to distribute the property as tenants in common to each of the two the heirs of the two original partners?
I believe that if by agreement, certainly. Anybody
okay.
can reach an agreement on anything.
Fine. So that being the case, we could have a situation where everything that has happened in the Court of Chancery needs only to be preceded by a stipulation that dissolves the partnership and places the property in title in the property in the two sets of heirs, correct?
If you're assuming that could be done by agreement or by
sure.
court order.
No, let's say by agreement.
Well, certainly it could be done by agreement, but obviously the parties could not agree to, or we wouldn't be here, agree to how the property should be so divided.
Well, apparently everybody did agree to how the property should be divided until it got to the end and your client didn't like which parcel your client got, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So basically, you've come up with a way to try again, correct?
No, I believe I've come up, when I reviewed the file initially, I looked at the basis for Chancery Court jurisdiction, and I looked at the relevant case law, and the relevant case law that I uncovered was the Lampow decision, and that indicated that you could not partition partnership property, that that would be an improper invocation of the Chancery Court jurisdiction under that statute, and then if the court in fact lacks jurisdiction, any action taken by the court, with if it in fact lacks jurisdiction, is void.
Well, what would prevent the court from entering an order, nunk-pro-tunk, is that the way it goes? Saying the original partnership is dissolved effective the day before this action was brought, and the property interest vest in the two sets of heirs.
My understanding, again, is that the court would not have to, there's no reason for the court to enter that order because the statute says that on the death of the partner, it dissolved under the pre-2000 version, that the partnership dissolved and it had to wind up its affairs. Winding up of its affairs, as I understand the statutory scheme, was to liquidate the asset and then distribute the proceeds.
See, but we're not talking on a clean slate here. We've got a whole proceeding that went along with your client's consent, participating in an action for proceeding for partition of property. And now your client has done an about-face because of disappointment in the result. And you're basing that about-face on absence of subject matter jurisdiction, because if there's no subject matter jurisdiction, what the court did has no effect. And I'm asking you why the court can't cure that defect in a way that eliminates the subject matter jurisdiction claim.
Because the subject matter jurisdiction that was invoked was a statutory jurisdiction of the court, and the winding up would be an alternative statutory jurisdiction of the court as opposed to a clear, equitable, no adequate remedy at law standard, and therefore I believe the court lacked jurisdiction because subject matter jurisdiction was statutorily invoked. And I've reserved 7 minutes for rebuttal that I've already gone over.
Good morning, Justice Berger, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Jacobs. May it please the court. Sean Lynn from the law firm Hudson Jones, Jaywerk & Fisher. I'm here this morning on behalf of the appellees John Lynch and Dewey Lynch. Now, the appellant in this case, Billy Lynn Thompson, and I'd refer to her with the court's permission throughout the balance of my argument as simply Thompson, appeals a decision by the Honorable William Chandler, Chancellor of the Court of the Chancery of the State of Delaware. Thompson advances her arguments in support of her appeal to this honorable court. To summarize her arguments, I see them as simply this. Number one, that the Court of Chancery erred as a matter of law when it determined that Thompson was barred from asserting that the court lacked subject matter jurisdiction to partition the subject property. And her second argument, that the court erred as a matter of law when it concluded that the Lynches had a clear intention to develop the property and Thompson did not, without a sufficient factual record to support that conclusion. With the court's permission, I would begin by addressing the first argument. In order to properly address this argument, I think it prudent to highlight certain factual items from the record of the Court of Chancery docket as transferred to this court on or about August 20th of 2009 and constituting the record as ordered. As the record will demonstrate, on or about July 1st of 2008, counsel for Thompson corresponded with the trial court and stated that Thompson is agreeable to the statutory commissioner's division of the property, provided she be awarded the western parcel adjacent to Route 1. That's Lexis docket entry number 8. On January 14, 2009, counsel for Thompson, in his memoranda of law, states, Ms. Thompson is willing to accept the eastern parcel subject to some equitable relief in order to equalize the values of the property. Alternatively, the court can always order a partition sale if it cannot equitably determine which party should receive a particular parcel. He goes on to state, Ms. Thompson requests the western parcel, and that Ms. Thompson requests an owlty to offset the unequal partition. On March 4th, in his responsive memorandum of law, Lexis docket number 17, counsel for Thompson states the entire annexation issue could be removed from discussion if the party awarded the western parcel is also ordered to annex both parcels into the city of Milford and pay the related annexation expenses.
Mr. Lynn,
yes, Your Honor.
Since we have a limited amount of time, can we get to the issues here?
Yes, Your Honor.
The first argument is that the chancellor committed an error as a matter of law because the newly discovered facts regarding the title to the property that was the subject of the partition or a requested partition ousted the Court of Chancery from jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, and subject matter jurisdiction cannot be conferred by agreement or by the application of estoppel principles. What is your response to that argument?
My response is twofold, Justice Jacobs. The first being that I don't think that Chancellor Chandler even got to the subject matter jurisdiction. His first response was, you're judicially stopped from even raising this argument given your conduct throughout the initial 2.5 years.
Yes, but then let me phrase my question a little more clearly. Let's assume for the moment that there would be no subject matter jurisdiction as a consequence of this new fact. Is it a correct statement of law to say that a party can be stopped in that circumstance from raising the jurisdictional issue?
The case that Your Honor is referring to, that equitable jurisdiction cannot be conferred by estoppel, was outlined in the appellant's brief, and I think it's the State Farm case. I think the State Farm case can be distinguished from the case herein at issue. In the State Farm case, what you have is a law being passed between two separate components of a litigation. I believe, from my recollection, it was the Administrative Procedures Act. So you had a change in law which gave rise to that argument being raised.
I'm just asking whether, if in fact subject matter jurisdiction was destroyed, then can the other side be precluded by way of estoppel or otherwise from raising that jurisdictional objection?
Well, I believe that the case law in State Farm would have us believe no, that estoppel does not allow jurisdiction to be conferred upon the trial court.
Okay. So at least as they phrase the argument, it's a valid argument. What's wrong with it?
I would agree, Your Honor. I think the problems with it are manifold, the first being that they rely heavily upon the Lump Law case, which I would point out is a Chancellor Chandler case, the same chancellor whose opinion that the appellants have appealed. Lump Law states, and I think it can be distinguished from the instant case in one major way. Lump Law and Sheridan, the partners in the Lump Law case, were living people with an active general partnership entitled Cedar Timber Homes. Here, the partners have been dead for a period of 19 and 14 years respectively, and the partnership hasn't been active for that period of time. In Lump Law, Chandler states there
How does that affect the jurisdiction?
Well, I think that the basis of their jurisdictional argument is that partition is not the correct statute to apply to the facts of this case because it's owned by an entity, which being one entity, there's no concurrence of ownership. Thus, partition is not applicable. However, I disagree in that in the lump law case, Chandler states that the partnership is changeable. The entity is changeable. There is authority for the view that the nature of a partnership is changeable depending on the issue before a court, and hence it is speculative to say that a partnership is always an entity under Delaware law. And I would say that this is one of the circumstances within which this partnership should not be considered an entity under Delaware law. It's not the same type of entity that was found in the lump law case, an active general partnership with living people. This is an entity that should have been wound up and terminated 19 to 14 years ago.
So are you arguing something like piercing the partnership veil or just ignoring its existence altogether as a separate landowning entity?
I would say it's something akin to piercing the partnership veil. I don't think that this should be treated as a partnership at this point. I don't think lump law is conclusive as to whether all partnerships cannot seek.
Chancellor didn't reason in that way in his opinion, did he?
He did not. He focused solely on judicial estoppel.
So is it correct to say that the way that analysis was wrong and he should have decided the case on some other basis?
Well, it certainly would have been helpful to me had he decided on another basis. But I think that if you believe Mr. Sergeyevich's recitation of the events, that if partition is inapplicable and equitable jurisdiction cannot be conferred by estoppel, then perhaps Chancellor Chandler's opinion in that regard was incorrect. But nevertheless, I think that we overcome that burden in that the entity here I don't think should be treated as a partnership under the lump law case.
Well, even if it is treated as a partnership, would that oust the court of jurisdiction?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because ultimately I think that it ends up in the Court of Chancery anyway, which makes all of this a huge exercise in futility. And I think Chancellor Chandler addressed that issue. On the last page of his opinion, Chandler directs Thompson to effectuate the dissolution of any partnership entity and, in accordance with 6 Delaware Code, Section 1537, to wind up the affairs of the partnership. So ultimately I think that it's going to be in the Court of Chancery regardless.
So once this issue of jurisdiction surfaced, your side could have moved to amend the complaint to add a claim for dissolution and winding up of the partnership to be followed by or combined with some sort of partition.
That's correct.
Following the winding up.
That is correct, Your Honor. We could have filed a motion for leave to file an amended complaint. However, it's still our contention that Chandler addressed the partnership issues in his order. It was an all-encompassing order. On page 6, he clearly states that the partnership is dissolved, and he directs the parties to seek dissolution in accordance with 6 Delaware Code. So I think he...
So the remedy then would be to order an amendment of the complaint to conform to the evidence?
Possibly. That's one remedy, Your Honor, or alternatively to hold that in this circumstance, this partnership should not be treated as an entity, and that there is concurrence of ownership amongst the heirs of Cheney and Dickerson.
So that while there may have been some unintended error in the choice of cause of action, that did not oust the court from subject matter jurisdiction. It basically required getting before the court the correct cause of action once the facts surfaced. Is that your point?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. Your Honor, leading from that question, there's a case that I think is somewhat on point, and that's the estate of Foraker case, which I cited in my brief. In that case, there was a partnership that similarly failed to distribute an asset upon its dissolution. 13 years go by, similar to the amount of time that goes by in the instant case. And one of the former partners claims that the partnership with its remaining asset, albeit in that case an inchoate asset, remained intact as its affairs had not properly been wound up. And although the court in Foraker focused its ruling in that particular case on the partnership's termination agreement, It held that even if the partnership had dissolved without such an agreement, the partners had not acted promptly to wind up its affairs, and that the opportunity to wind up had long since expired, which I think is pertinent and relevant to this case. If 13 years is too long of a period of time for a partnership to take to wind up its affairs, then clearly 19 to 14 years is too long for a partnership to take to wind up its affairs.
Even if that's true, don't we still have a problem with the title to the land? I mean, the record shows that this partnership, which admittedly should have been wound up years ago, didn't wind up. And so something has to be done formally to straighten out the title.
I agree, Your Honor. What we don't want is avoid judgment and a title defect. But I think, again, Chancellor Chandler plugs that hole in his opinion when he directs Thompson to effectuate the dissolution of the partnership.
Dissolution or winding up?
He directs Thompson, the words that Chandler used, and I'm quoting from page 6 of his order, is he directs Thompson to effectuate the dissolution of any partnership entity and, in accordance with 6 Delaware Code, section 1537, to wind up the affairs of any partnership so that the findings and rulings of the master's final report can be fully implemented.
So is it fair to say that the chancellor exercised a form of ancillary jurisdiction and issued an order that, in effect, would have required Mr. Sergeyevich's client to, on behalf of the partnership, to deed the property to herself and to your client as tenants in common?
That's absolutely the argument that I'm making, Your Honor. I think that Chandler did an effective job of plugging that hole and sua sponte took jurisdiction over the partnership aspect of the case so that there wouldn't be a void judgment or a title defect. I think that he addressed Sergeyevich's arguments raised in the exception process and effectively plugged the hole. Addressing the second argument raised by the appellant, specifically that there was an incomplete record below and that the master's findings were clearly erroneous. Again, Your Honor, we would take issue with the clearly erroneous standard as outlined in the Sergeyevich's second argument. The standard of review to support Thompson's second argument is the clearly erroneous standard. Sergeyevich cites it in Berglund versus Horgan, which quotes a federal case, United States versus United States Gypsum, and which states that on the entire evidence, the court is left with a definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been committed. Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 52, also quoted in Berglund versus Horgan, states that the master's finding of fact must be adopted unless clearly erroneous. Here, I don't think the master's finding
But that, that whole argument presupposes that the record is complete. And then it goes to the question of whether the record is sufficient to support a particular finding of fact. The argument here is that the record isn't complete and that Mr. Sergeyevich's client was precluded erroneously from making a proper record. What is your response to that argument?
What I think is interesting is that there was a teleconference held by Master Glasscock on or about December 18th of 2008. And in that teleconference, there were proffers made to the court of the parties' respective positions relative to the case and how to proceed from December 18th on forward. And Master Glasscock specifically asked counsel for Thompson the following question, and I'm reading it and quoting it verbatim, and it may sound disjointed, but that's what the transcript reflects. Master Glasscock states, "All right, so Mr. Lindauer, let me see if I understand your point. Your point is that because Mr. and then there's a dash, and your client's not interested in developing the property, correct?" Now, if the record below were incomplete and that Thompson had never taken the position before that she was not going to develop the property, why would Master Glasscock ask that question, seemingly a non sequitur? The rest of the teleconference says nothing about the intent to develop. Only here, out of thin air, does Master Glasscock say, "And it's not your client's intent to develop."
Let me get ask the question a different way.
Understood, Your Honor.
In the proceedings before the Chancellor, was any argument made that Mr. Sergeyevich's client was improperly precluded from making a record?
No, Your Honor. I think that they had an ample opportunity to make a record, and that the record...
Now, did they argue that they were precluded wrongfully from making a record? Was that before the court?
No, Your Honor. I think that they had every opportunity to make a record. In point of fact, there was a record made by proffers made to the court by counsel. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't think I'm answering your question in the manner
The question is, did they argue to Chancellor Chandler that he should not approve the report because the master wrongfully precluded Mr. Sergeyevich's client from completing the record?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that that is the basis.
They did make that argument.
They did,
and,
Your Honor.
And what was your response?
I
that they had a proper opportunity.
They absolutely had an opportunity to make a record.
And would you make that argument here? That is, what's the basis for the argument that they had an opportunity?
Well, there were several hearings scheduled, and I think that if my recollection is correct, at the December 18th teleconference, one of the issues that was discussed is submitting briefs in lieu of, to determine who gets the Western parcel in lieu of a hearing. So I think that they had the opportunity to make a record by and through the briefs, and certainly counsel for Thompson on a number of occasions corresponded with the court about their position. I mean, their position is clearly delineated in the December 18th teleconference transcript, where counsel states, correct, Your Honor, she doesn't want to not be able to do it in the future if that's the way she should decide to go. But at this point it's in time, it's not her intent to be a land developer. I mean, I think that they clearly had an opportunity to
request a factual hearing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it unreasonable to classify the master's decision as clearly erroneous. The master rendered his decision after speaking with the parties, considering their multiple memoranda, and reviewing the expert findings of the statutory commissioners that Thompson herself requested.
Well, I will ask opposing counsel as well, but is it your recollection that there is any brief or memorandum or letter that was submitted either to the master or to the chancellor in which Mr. Sergeyevich's client said, actually, I am interested in developing the parcel now?
There was, and please understand, Your Honor, this is my recollection, there was correspondence from Mr. Lindauer, who was counsel for Ms. Thompson at the trial court level, that indicated that she wished to pursue annexation, but nothing to my recollection that indicated that she wished to develop the property.
Okay.
I think it's a well-understood fact from being a participant in the trial court level that it was her intent not to develop the property, which is why I would state that that's the reason why Master Glasscock posed that question in the December 18th teleconference. It was a complete non sequitur, and he clearly stated, and it's not your client's intent to develop, correct? There was no discussion prior to that comment being made about development, and I think that it was the understanding of all parties involved that development was not on the table. Your Honor, that concludes my oral argument. I'd like to thank you for your consideration here today, and I still have a few more seconds if there are any additional questions.
Thank you.
It's been a privilege, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Jacobs, Justice Berger. Thank you.
Again, I'll turn to the second question first. I think the problem with the record is that Ms. Thompson was not fully apprised by the master that the critical issue is for his determination was annexation. In the rebuttal brief submitted to the master in the final briefing, there was a commitment by Ms. Thompson to annex, and again, I'm not exactly sure how they phrased it, but the order in the west side of the portion, which she deemed more valuable, she'd annex it under either a bond or something like that. So the question of annexation, I think, was a factual question. There was no direct evidence on it. It really wasn't a question of development. Nobody was going to develop this property in 2008 because it would be economic suicide. And there's nothing in the record as to was annexation feasible, what would happen in the context of annexation. So the critical factual determination by the master was completely devoid of any real evidence to support, you know, a determination that I will grant you the western portion conditioned upon you annexing it, and that would produce the highest and best value. There's just simply no evidence.
Let me interrupt you, because I thought that in addition to annexation, there was a finding made that opposing counsel's clients did intend to develop the property as soon as possible, and that your client, either directly or through counsel, indicated that she has no present intention to develop the property.
Well, again, the question really was not development. The question was annexation.
Well, the record uses the word develop.
Well, but again, the development isn't the critical issue. The issue was because the property lies on Delaware Route 1, in order to maximize the value of the property, the theory was that it had to be brought into the city of Milford by annexation to maximize the value. Whether somebody was going to actually develop or not develop doesn't really make any difference. The question was whether annexation would occur so that both parcels...
Okay, but before any development could happen, the annexation had to happen, right?
Not necessarily. I'm not sure what could be done with the property and its zoning status in Kent County. I just don't know. But because I'm running very short on time, let me go back to the jurisdictional argument, because I think it's really the critical one. The difference between the statutory jurisdiction of the court under the Partnership Act and under the Partition Act is the fact that the legal scenario set up by the legislature. Under the partition statute, there's the commission who's statutorily embodied to make a determination, which is set forth in the statute, that says basically you should try to partition this in kind unless there's an economic detriment by doing so. That there is no parallel statutory remedy or protocol under the partnership statute, and I think that's a very critical issue as to why the court did not have jurisdiction to render the decision it rendered, because the commission was only embodied by the partition statute and not by the Partnership Act. That's not to say that the court could not have, in its equitable powers, perhaps conceived a similar remedy, but it was not statutorily commanded under the Partnership Act, and I don't think it really follows under the Partnership Act, because the Partnership Act contemplates that the asset will be sold, and the court has...
You're telling us that the partnership statute precludes the distribution of assets in kind?
No, I'm not saying that.
So what are you telling us when you say it contemplates that the assets, that the partnership assets will be sold?
Because
that might be an option, but it's not a mandate, is it?
My reading of the statute is that the partnership statute contemplates the sale of the assets, and only if you have unsaleable assets do you then distribute them. That is my understanding of the partnership statutory scheme. And I think this partnership statutory scheme primarily directs the partner to, the surviving partner, to liquidate and wind up. And I see that my time is up, and I appreciate the opportunity to present the arguments on behalf of my client, Ms. Thompson.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll recess and take the case under advisement.